Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See why CNBC ranks Minnesota number 4 best state to live and work. A great place to work, an even better place to live. ExploreMinnesota.com/live.
What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And we don't just mean the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out, the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers? The Home Depot has an idea. Let Mom's green thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens. Right now, get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 for strong, healthy, vibrant plants indoors and outside. Shop our wide selection online and pick up your order in-store and give Mom the gift of a beautiful garden. Get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin.
I am Ben Bolin, and Scott, we're pretty lucky today.
Why is that?
Well, I'm glad you asked. No, we are pretty lucky because if this podcast were a train, we would easily be delayed for several hours before we started.
I don't know. What is this? You're attacking the subject. I can't believe it.
I'm not attacking the subject. I'm attacking a stereotype of the subject.
I'm kidding. Yeah, because unfortunately, Ben, I think there's kind of a negative twist on all this.
There is. Let's go ahead and tell everybody, Scott. Let's let this cat out of the bag because we are going to cover some stuff about Amtrak today. And just from the jump, listeners, please note, all of it is true. Not all of it is good.
That's right. Yeah, there's some good to it.
There's some good.
But a lot of the bad stuff comes in when you're talking about some of the funding. Some of the dollar amounts that we're talking about, because I heard some stuff just today, and we'll get to that too.
But, yeah,
a little bad news on the radio. Anyways, you want to get into the history of Amtrak, and I'm sure most people know what we're talking about, right? I mean, I would think
Amtrak is a for-profit service. Actually, Amtrak is technically known as the National Railroad Passenger Corporation. Now, it operates passenger trains. In 46 of our states, it also goes in DC, and they've got service in Canada. Mm-hmm. And they have been Amtrak was created, in 1970 by Congress when they passed the Rail Passenger Service Act. Now that's kind of weird because, this move itself was sort of an attempt to save passenger rail, because before this time, when U.S. train travel was one of the only consistently reliable ways for a private individual to make it across the country without resorting to a horse or a wagon, or dangerous roads, which we talked about too, a lot of people would travel on these freight railroads for passenger service, but these services were not very profitable for the railroad companies. And we started to see a decline in service. So in the 1970s, when Congress created Amtrak, it was to take over passenger service from the railroad companies. Now, once they created this in 1970, the next year, 1971, Amtrak is incorporated in D.C., and it's supposed to take over the passenger carrying obligations of private railroads.
Okay. Can I stop you here for just 1 second?
Stop me here.
This is one of those things that I was shocked to learn that Amtrak had only been around since 1971.
Yes.
I don't know why, but I just had the impression. Now, of course, that happens to be the year I was born, 1971. Now, it's been around my whole life.
Okay.
I had the impression that this was a company that had been around since, I don't know, the 1920s, 1930s.
Sure. Railroad expansion company.
I felt that that was the case with this one. I just didn't know that it had a relatively recent start.
Mm-hmm.
That was surprising to me.
And it's also, let's see, and it's doing, well, I don't want to say it's doing pretty well, but it has over 500 locations. And it also has, let's see, let me get to where.
Yeah, be careful about the doing well thing.
Don't. Yeah. By doing well, I mean they're still running.
Yeah, but still there.
We'll get there.
Okay.
All right, so Amtrak right now, or not right now, but they have more than 20,000 route miles, and those are mostly on, see, freight carriers still own a lot of the rail.
Okay.
And Amtrak is just using it to provide this passenger service. Now, just for a kind of a snapshot of how many people ride these vehicles, in 2001, there were over 3.7 million travelers at Philadelphia's 30th Street station alone. So one station, one year, over 3 million, almost 4 million travelers.
Really?
Right, which is, you know, kind of
respectable.
Yeah, it's respectable, and it's sort of a number that we forget sometimes when we talk about a lot of the other Amtrak numbers.
Yeah.
Now, before we get into the real juice, the real red meat of this, one or two words about who is in charge of Amtrak. Amtrak has a board of directors, and there are seven of them. They each get appointed for 5 years by the president with Senate, you know, like how the president can nominate a judge on advice and consent of the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of the same way. The president always elects or appoints a secretary of transportation as one of the board members. Now we're going to segue into these numbers that Scott and I keep talking about. The Federal Railroad Administration supplies some support to the Secretary of Transport and other board members. And the Railroad Administration is also in charge of administering federal grants to Amtrak. Now, Scott, you've got some numbers on this.
Yeah,
right?
I do. Okay, here's the scoop on this. And this is why I said it's not all good news, really. Here's the thing, Ben. Way back in 1971, when this all started,
mm-hmm.
It was supposed to be a 2-year federal undertaking to revive and hopefully save the inner city rail and passenger service in the United States, okay?
Yep.
The Congress awarded them grants of $40 million for operations and $100 million for new equipment, okay? And it's supposed to be a 2-year federal undertaking.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it was supposed to be completely self-supporting after those 2 years. That was the plan, right?
Right. That's the plan.
Well, you and I know that this year, now this is what I heard today when I turned on the radio.
Mm.
That I went out to lunch and I turned on the radio and the very first sentence that I heard today, just pure coincidence, they were talking about budget and deficits and, you know, what they're trying to cut out of the federal budget. The thing that they mentioned was they're trying to cut $400 million out of the budget from Amtrak alone. So we're still giving them at least that much. I didn't look into the numbers for this year, but they're trying to cut $400 million from Amtrak, which they called, and their words not mine, a huge money pit.
The money pit.
And so you can imagine that, you know, that we're now at 40 years
mm-hmm.
of taxpayer funding of Amtrak in a sense. I mean, we've got quite a bit of money has gone to them over the years, and I can kind of go through this if you want.
Lay it on me,
man. Okay, let's see. This is starting around, let's see, 19 – well, we talked about the first 2 years,
mm-hmm.
The $40 million for operations, $100 million for new equipment, right?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that's not the first time we've had to do that. But in 73, there was something called the OPEC oil crisis. Remember that? That actually drove up transportation. This was actually a good time for Amtrak. And you would
right.
think that, you know, this would help, you know, get them back on the right track, so to speak.
Yes.
But how long was it going to be before we said something like that? Get them on the right track. Anyways, okay, so Congress gave – but by 1974 – Congress gave Amtrak another $179.1 million in grants and another $100 million in loans.
Wow.
And 1976, Congress authorized $1.9 billion over 5 years to rebuild and improve tracks and facilities.
Oh, one note?
Yeah.
We've hit our first B in funding, our first billion.
That's right. And this is all the way back in 1976. So that's 1976 dollars, $1.9 billion over 5 years to rebuild. So let's see. Now, I guess between 1971 and 1975, if you want to go back a little bit, Amtrak had $900 million in loans given to them. And let's see, the average revenue, this is where it was supposed to balance out.
Right.
$252 million. So that's less than 40% of its operating costs at that point. The Carter administration wanted it to, wanted them to cut costs and, you know, get the efficiency up, of course. But by the 1980s, you know, when the Reagan administration was around, they wanted to make cuts again. And, the thing is, it was cheaper to buy an airline ticket at that point. Mm-hmm. So let's say if you're going to fly from, or you're going to take a train from New York to Chicago, it would actually cost the taxpayers less if the government was to hand out airline tickets at that point to every passenger that is now taking the train because of the dollars that we're sinking into train travel.
Which made some opponents of the Amtrak program and rail in general, passenger rail in general, let's be honest, allege that this company was indeed a scam track.
I'll bet.
I'm sorry. Do you see my post?
I see it. You got a few there, don't you?
I showed this to you downstairs.
Yeah, I know. You gotta work those in somehow. Okay.
Anyway, sorry.
So I'm sorry. We're going on with these bad numbers here, but this is just
these are the facts.
Yeah, this is the way it goes, and I'm sure that there are good times along with this, but this is kind of the road we're taking here. So, trying to tie into today's news, really, the one that I heard on the radio.
Right.
So then, of course, there's the air traffic controller strike, and that was when, you know, trains were actually a little bit more valuable again.
Yes.
So we had the OPEC crisis. We had the air traffic controller strike. But by the late 1980s, Amtrak was, they had $1.2 billion in revenues, which is pretty good, right? Because they went up from, what did I say earlier, the average revenue was around $252. They're up to $1.2 billion in revenue, which
nothing
is good.
Nothing to sneeze at.
Yeah, but the operating costs were over $2 billion at that point. So they're never quite in the black here. Federal grants up to $221 million in 1981, $2 million $2 million in 1986. It's just it.
I've got a number that's going to blow your mind, dude.
Sure.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
I don't want to leapfrog you.
Well, where are you going to go? What year?
I'm going to go to the future.
How far?
The big one, newest plan.
Oh, yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Are you sure?
Yeah, sure.
Can you catch up?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So part of the $129 billion transportation budget.
Billion with a B.
Billion with a B. That's for Benjamin, either one. Now this, this budget, this $129 billion number, is for the U.S. Department of Transportation General. So, how much of this is going to high-speed rail? Well, over fiscal year 2012, there's going to be $8 billion going to fiscal rail. And over 6 years, there's going to be $53 billion, as in Benjamin's, to build a nationwide high-speed rail network.
Oh, boy.
So this thing has had some issues, I think is the nicest way to say it, as a for-profit company, right? And this is the current plan, is to essentially trying to revitalize high-speed rail for passengers. It's the same thing that we tried to do in 1970.
We've talked about this, haven't we? We've talked about high-speed rail and some of the problems associated with said rail, right?
The enormous cost of the infrastructure.
The costs are unbelievable. I mean, you got people, I think the government in Florida turned down $25 billion in federal grants to build a high-speed rail because they didn't want to deal with the upkeep afterwards.
Yeah.
Because the cost of maintenance and just the fact that it probably wouldn't be used.
That's true, because when we talk about building rail infrastructure, even if that enormous cost is transferred effectively, somehow gone through the system effectively, it's still going to choke up the system. It's like when a snake eats a really big animal it shouldn't have messed with. You know, it's going to have a definite economic effect. And the idea is that this will, over the long term, have a very beneficial economic effect for a large group of people. And that argument, there's evidence to back that claim up in other countries. But again, for people who've listened to our High Speed Rail podcast, one of the big differences between the United States and a lot of other countries that have such effective and ubiquitous rail systems is that the United States is huge by comparison.
Yeah, and you know what? One argument against it here in the United States is that it's just not – Our cities aren't planned the right way for something like this to really work. Mm-hmm. We've spread out into suburbs and the populations are so spread out. Sure, there's a massive population in major cities.
Sure.
But, look at a city like Los Angeles that's spread out over miles and miles and miles. Mm-hmm. Look here at Atlanta. Look how far the Atlanta metro area is spread out.
Sure.
You can't make one or two, high-speed rail stops that are convenient for everybody to get to. It's just not set up the same way as it would, you know, like a European system or an Asian system works. It's not as feasible. I don't know how to say this the right way, I guess.
It's fiscally feasible.
I guess. I'm saying that, almost physically possible, really.
Yeah.
The possibility of getting to the stations, it's just more of a headache to get to the station to get on the train than it is to just head whatever direction you're going anyways, unless you're heading across the country, in which case it still doesn't make really much sense. And there's also this thing, getting the right of way for the tracks. Is that eminent domain?
Eminent domain. Yeah. But it's a hugely controversial property rights issue.
Of course. You're going to be going over properties. You're going to be buying out people, farmland, whatever it is. It's very, very expensive.
And then also, let's just take a second and I want to make sure everybody knows, we're being honest about Amtrak. We're not doing a hit piece on Amtrak.
Not by any means.
I think what it sounds like we're both saying is one of the problems that we're seeing here with the funding or trying to build that sort of infrastructure is that this is a top-down approach. And maybe what is more appropriate would be building city and then regional and then intercity hubs so that you have pieces to connect, because it's a lot easier to connect existing things than it is to build something new and try to do it from a centralized location.
Okay, I've got a different view of this, but you probably would guess this anyways.
Lay it on me.
I'm such a huge fan of personal transportation.
Yes.
Of course.
But
honestly, I tell you, the United States and the way that I see it, it's just not set up for mass transit the way other places are. We're just not built for that. We were made for. I mean, goes all the way back to the bus scandal, or what was the name of that?
The electric trolley cars.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
I forget the name of it exactly, but this goes all the way back to that, where you know we decided that we were going to build an infrastructure of highways and roadways and personal transportation was going to be the way for us to get around.
Right.
We eliminated our early attempts at something like, you know, mass transit, something that may have worked at the time. We've gone past that point. I don't know if it's possible to overlay that on top of what we've already got.
Right. After we've spent billions of dollars in decades.
Yeah.
You could even say hundreds of billions of dollars, I think, in decades, working toward a private vehicle infrastructure.
Yeah. But at the same time, we're pouring billions and billions of dollars. Mm-hmm. I don't know an exact number, but billions and billions of dollars on the existing train system that we've got, this Amtrak service, the service, I should say.
Yeah.
Of course, we need trains for freight and, you know, whatever else we need for, but, I don't know if it's possible, like I said, to overlay a high speed rail system on top of the extensive interstate system that we've already got. And that's just the main point here in my mind. I mean, I'm sure we're going to get people that, you know, say that, you know, we're full of it and, you know, that it would work and here's why. I'd like to hear their opinions.
Yeah, I'd like
to.
Because
there's a back and forth about this all over the place. I mean, you'll find pro and con in every article you read about this, mostly.
Yes.
But, you know, my personal belief is that it's just going to be a tough integration.
And also, let's not forget that if this sort of infrastructure is implemented, which we see people attempting to do mm-hmm. on local, regional, and federal levels, but if this infrastructure does eventually become a real thing, I mean, let's be honest, if it really does reach the levels that are spelled out in the legislation, then Amtrak is probably still going to be the nominal primary mover there, right?
I would think so. Yeah, they're the ones we've been entrusting this type of travel to for 40 years at this point.
Right, and they have yet to turn a profit.
Well, yeah,
have they?
I think
did they profit?
I think that they maybe not. I think I've got numbers here for 1996.
Okay,
maybe where they had maybe not. Nope, sorry.
Because it's their expenses versus their revenues, right?
Yeah.
Like in 2007, their expenses exceeded their revenues to the tune of around $1 billion.
Oh, boy.
So
a billion-dollar loss.
Yeah, and there's a lot of controversy about railroad accidents that occur with Amtrak. You mm-hmm. know, we've heard a lot about that. I've got a quick stat here. So from 2000 to 2003, there was an average of between 60 to 80 deaths, fatalities involving
wow.
casualties by railroad. So that's not the same as highway rail crossing incidents mm-hmm. where you would like cross in a car and get hit.
Sure.
That number averages between about 40 and 70 over per year over those years. And I've got a list of big Amtrak accidents, but I'm not going to read all of them.
You know what, Ben? I'm feeling kind of bad that this is
I know. I feel like we're kicking it while it's down.
I really don't mean to do that.
I mean,
there's something really romantic about being able to take a train across the country
mm-hmm.
and see the entire countryside. I mean, it's got its good points for sure.
Yeah.
You know, it's great if you don't have to be there immediately, like if you're not taking a plane.
Sure.
It's probably more comfortable travel than being in your car, I would guess.
And definitely more comfortable in a coach seat on a plane.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah, for sure. But, like my grandparents had taken a train ride up to Alaska
mm-hmm.
and, you know, really enjoyed that. That was nice country to see.
Yeah.
I haven't taken long train rides, but shorter train rides, and I've always enjoyed it.
Yeah, that's the thing. I really want to have, rail options in cities.
Mm-hmm.
I am kind of on the same page with you about national rail for the United States. Just the distances and the money and the legislation involved they're very daunting. But inside of a city, I think it's very feasible. You know, we've got some public transit ideas people are cooking up here in Atlanta. But also when it comes to Amtrak, I really do want to ride it. I want to check it out. And, now, I might get some hate mail from this for both sides of the aisle for saying it. I want to be able to ride on Amtrak while it's still here. Now that immediately, I know there are going to be some people who are opponents of Amtrak or do not support it who say that it will never go away because it's a pork shed, basically. But then there's going to be a second group of people who are saying that you guys are saying terrible things about Amtrak. The facts may not be pretty. But they are the facts.
Yeah, the facts are what they are. And, I agree with you. I mean, I'd like to take a train ride. You know, like we said, you know, it has to be one of those situations where you don't have to be anywhere really fast.
Right.
And also, you know, you pay for it, of course, like you would an airline ticket or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But you pay for any form of travel. You pay for fuel in a car. You pay for fuel in a seat on a plane. You pay for a train ride. You pay for a boat ride, everything else. So, you know, it's understandable that they charge what they do and why they do it. But like, I don't know if it's just not the most effective form of travel for us right now.
As it stands.
Yeah. I mean, you get 3 days off of work or whatever, you know, on a weekend and you want to go somewhere nearby. You don't necessarily want to get on a train and spend one entire day traveling there. You might want to get on a plane and make it a couple of hours.
Yeah, that's, you know what, that's one of the primary arguments I do have. I was thinking, Scott, I wanted to close out with this because I was thinking of reasons why we would continue to fund Amtrak. Like, mm-hmm. what explains it? And you know what I thought of? I started thinking of food subsidies in Western Europe because, you know, that's a huge issue there that a lot of Western European governments spend huge amounts of money fighting in the EU for how food is subsidized and supporting their local growers. And it took me a second to think of it, but they're not subsidizing it just for the profits of their voters. They're also subsidizing it because if something goes wrong, in a country, it needs to be able to domestically produce its own food.
Sure. Self-sustaining.
Right. And so with the rail, the Amtrak funding and the infrastructure, it could possibly be a strategic concern on the part of our government. Like what would you do if something was wrong with the highways? You need an alternate route of transportation. Now, it's not the best argument, but I do think there are some possible strategic advantages to keep it running.
Not a bad link.
Not a bad link, but we'll see if I'm right or wrong about that, depending on what happens to Amtrak over the next 6 years.
Yeah, I'm interested too. I want to find out where all this goes, because right now it kind of hangs in the balance.
I know.
They're talking about budget cuts and what may or may not happen and how the funding is going to go for this high-speed rail system, if it will or will not happen.
Right.
That's the big decision right now, so we'll see.
Because let us not forget that other presidents and other Congress sessions have tried before.
That's right.
Not just here, but in multiple countries. High-speed rail is a very difficult thing to do. All right, Scott. I'm about tapped out, so I just want to say that one of the clever puns I didn't get to make in this podcast was Jamtrak, which I was going to use to describe a party on a train.
Jamtrak.
Jamtrak.
Cool. Very cool.
Thank you, man.
Kind of hipster lingo.
You know, I do these for you. we're gonna go ahead and head out. Guys, we've given you a really quick look at some of the challenges Amtrak is facing, some of the stories about how Amtrak got started and what it does. Now, we want to hear your opinions now. Most importantly, I think, Scott, I think I know what you want to hear, which is, tell me if I get this wrong. Does Amtrak have a place, a future in the modern United States? If yes, why? If no, why not? You can contact us and tell us about that on Twitter. You can tell us about that on Facebook. You can drop a line at our blog. Or, as always, you can email us directly at
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The How Stuff Works iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See why CNBC ranks Minnesota number 4 best state to live and work. A great place to work, an even better place to live. ExploreMinnesota.com/live.
With the new Dexcom G7, you can achieve better diabetes results without painful finger sticks. It sends your glucose numbers to your compatible phone or watch, so you can always see where you are and where you're heading. See how food and exercise affects your glucose, making it easier to spend more time in range and lower your A1C. Take control of your diabetes with the number 1 recommended CGM brand. It's easy to get started today at Dexcom.com. That's Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com/compatibility.
Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.